yay, oh yay, oh yay. The Honorable Court of Appeals for the Second District of Texas is now in session.
Thank you. Be seated, please. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. This is the November 5th docket, and we've got two cases set for hearing this morning, and I'll ask the clerk to call the first one.
May it please the court, Mr. David Richards will argue for appellant. Mr. Gregory Astor will argue for the state.
All right. Mr. Richards.
Thank you, Judge Holman. May it please the court, Mr. Astor. I represent Mr. Andrew Michael Crump. I didn't write the brief in this case. I was retained after Mr. Don Gandy wrote the brief. Mr. Crump was represented at trial by Travis Young, a Fort Worth attorney. Mr. Crump was convicted of the offense of aggravated robbery. The issue on appeal is whether the state was permitted to introduce extrinsic evidence of an extraneous crime, that being whether or not Mr. Crump was responsible for the theft of a truck that he drove after he went into the jewelry store, which was the location of the crime in this case. Now, it's important to understand that the issue in this case was not one of identity. It wasn't a case of who committed a crime. Mr. Crump admitted that he went into the jewelry store. Now, his explanation for why he went in was that he intended to get a Father's Day present for his father, and he wasn't intending to commit an offense. But after looking at some watches, he said it was kind of a spur-of-the-moment decision on his part to grab some watches and try to run out of the store. So what he admitted to was committing a robbery. Okay. The question was whether or not he used a deadly weapon during the commission of that offense. And there was some evidence, it was caught on videotape, that he displayed what appeared to be a weapon. Now, when Mr. Crump testified, he said that was not a gun. That was a toy gun. It was a soft BB pellet gun that he used, and that this toy gun had belonged to his nephew, and that he had had that on him. He panicked when he couldn't get the door of the store open. It was one of those, as a lot of jewelry stores are now, a locking door, and you have to buzz in, I guess, to get in, and you have to buzz out, or at least they have the ability to control whether the door is unlocked or locked to get out. When he went to get out, the door was locked. He testified he panicked. He pulled out this toy gun, which he displayed. They unlocked the door. He ran out of the store. So, again, the question is not whether or not Mr. Crump is guilty of some offense. The question is whether Mr. Crump was guilty of robbery or aggravated robbery. If you believe the gun was a toy, it's robbery. If you believe it was not a toy, it's aggravated robbery. And the judge allowed the jury in the jury instructions to convict him of either offense based on their determination of that issue. Now, the question on appeal concerns whether or not the state was properly entitled to bring in evidence of this extraneous truck theft. The state contend a number of things. First, they contend the issue wasn't properly preserved by an appropriate trial objection. They contend then that the truck robbery, the truck stealing was res justi of this offense, and then they contend ultimately that any error was harmless in the event that the court determines that there was error. Now, as far as the objection goes, the state takes the position on appeal that there wasn't a timely objection, and they contend that the defendant opened the door for this testimony. Appellant's position is that he made an appropriate objection and that the door wasn't opened. Now, when Mr. Crump testified, what he said was he gave the testimony relating to the entire event. First, why he was in the store, then the impulse that led him to grab the watches, then the display of the gun, and then that he left afterwards. And what he said was, in response to his own attorney's questioning, I left in the truck. And the question was, well, who, you know, what truck did you leave in? And he said, I left in the truck that I borrowed from a friend named Zach, and I was going back to his house. The question was, well, was it Zach's truck? And he said, well, I thought it was when I borrowed it, but I later learned that he didn't own it. And I think the clear implication of the testimony is that Mr. Crump was saying that he initially believed that he was in possession of the truck legally and could drive it, and then later learned that that was not true, and that he was in possession of the truck illegally, but that he wasn't aware that the truck had been stolen. The state, after Mr. Crump gave that testimony, asked that they approach the court, and then out of hearing of the jury, the prosecutor said, Judge, you know, this is getting into an extraneous offense, but we believe he's opened the door for that testimony. And the judge said, well, yeah, basically I think so too, and you didn't even need to approach the bench, is the gist of what the judge did. And the state was permitted to cross-examine Mr. Crump about that issue. Well, apparently they weren't satisfied with the jury knowing that the truck was stolen, because that was the subject of the cross-examination. They called a witness with a law enforcement agency in Weatherford. The robbery occurred in Fort Worth, but they called a witness to testify as to the facts of the truck having been stolen, over objection, over Mr. Young's objection, that they were getting into an extraneous offense. Now, the trial court, Judge Wilson, went through a 404 and a 403 analysis. That is, she determined whether or not this, in effect, was an extraneous offense, and then she did the balancing test to determine whether or not its probative value outweighed any prejudice from its admission, and she found that it was admissible. On appeal, we're contending the, you know, whether that was a correct ruling, and we're contending on appeal that it was an abuse of discretion for the trial court to have made that determination that it was admissible. In effect, what you have here is the question at trial: was it a toy gun? Was it a real gun? And what did the state bring in to prove that? They brought in an extraneous offense as to whether or not the truck that Mr. Crump left in was stolen by him, or whether or not he had borrowed it from his friend Zach. There was actually absolutely no connection between the question of whether or not the truck was stolen and whether or not the gun was a toy. Absolutely no connection at all. And Mr. Gandy, in his brief, cited Lockhart versus State in support of his proposition that this was an abuse of discretion to allow this in. And I think Lockhart versus Case is very much on point. In Lockhart, the defendant was charged with the offense of capital murder, and the question was, in that case, was, of course, whether the defendant had committed the capital crime charged. The state sought to prove that, in proving that up, that there was a gun that was used in the commission of the capital murder that had been stolen in a prior bank robbery and a burglary that was subsequently used. The gun was subsequently used in a bank robbery. And the Court of Criminal Appeals said, no, it's a 1992 decision that did constitute an abuse of discretion because there was no connection. It didn't tend to prove anything as to whether or not the defendant was guilty of the capital crime charge. It simply showed he was guilty or may have been guilty of an earlier crime completely unconnected with the capital offense he was on trial for.
What was the time lapse in Lockhart between the gun and the
Judge, I am not sure. Let me see.
Well, do you think that's a relevant factor?
No, I don't think that it's relevant because it was, in our case, the time lapse was 4 days, apparently. The truck had been stolen some 4 days earlier. So whether in Lockhart, the length of time between the capital offense and the bank robbery that then occurred subsequent to a burglary, I don't think the timeline is important there. If it had been 4 days, it had been 2 days, it had been 4 months, I think that the Court of Criminal Appeals' opinion would have been the same. I'm just not aware of what the length of time mm-hmm. was there in the Lockhart case.
Well, it seems like the state is arguing that the fact of the that the truck was stolen was part of helped to show that there was he had pre-planned to do this robbery, and somehow.
Yeah, Judge, I think their exact argument was that it's res justi of the offense. I'm not so sure that if they're arguing that it showed planning, I didn't pick okay. that up from their brief, and it may be in there. I thought they were saying it was res justi, meaning it was contextual of the offense. It tended to show the background of the testimony. And first of all, the concept of res justi in as it's developed in Texas is somewhat controversial, because it's often been used to permit what appellate courts have later determined have been inappropriate analysis to whether extraneous offenses are admissible or not. But I think that without doubt, the prejudicial impact of this type of testimony, whether or not you consider it res justi of the offense, is an analysis that the trial court clearly erred in conducting. Whether in knowing how this offense was conducted, it was important for the jury to understand that the truck had been stolen 4 days earlier, adds nothing to the issue that the jury was in this case there to determine whether or not the gun was a toy or whether it was real. Adds absolutely nothing to that. So it would be the appellant's contention that the trial court did abuse her discretion in determining and permitting the state to introduce this evidence, and we'd ask for a reversal of both phases of the trial to allow a jury to reconsider the issues in this case without the prism of an extraneous offense as prejudicial as the offense permitted in this case.
You don't think that he opened the door by testifying that it was Zach's truck and he thought it was Zach's truck?
Well, he would open the door for the admission. I think he could be cross-examined on that. But to actually then introduce evidence subsequent to that is impeachment on a collateral issue, which is not permitted. Yeah, to the extent that that he opened the door, I believe that the state was permitted to cross-examine him about that. It's when they went then to the trouble or the effort of proving up the prior offense by calling witnesses who had nothing to say about whether or not this gun was a toy or real, and proving up the offense in Weatherford to the extent that they did. So I do believe he opened the door, but not to the extent that the state would suggest. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Richards. Mr. Heister.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Greg Eisner, and I represent the state in this matter. This case is about the proper introduction of extraneous offense during the guilt innocent phase of appellant's trial. As Mr. Richards noted, we have several grounds that we believe this court can rely on to affirm the conviction. First, appellant did not properly preserve error. Related to that issue, appellant opened the door to this extraneous offense. And finally, the evidence can be considered same transaction, contextual evidence. Courts have continually held that in order to properly preserve error, a specific and timely objection has to be made when the objectionable evidence is introduced. Failure to do so will forfeit any complaint about the admissibility of the evidence. In this particular case, as Mr. Richards mentioned, after appellant testified, the state approached the bench and had a bench conference. And that's when they declared their intention to cross-examine and go into this extraneous issue. It was at that time, and even the trial court stated, I mean, he brought it up. It was at that time that the state argues was the proper time to object. Even if the court doesn't accept that notion, when the state then cross-examined appellant, the state cross-examined, it took about three pages of the record, and I point you to page 7 of my brief. We cross-examined appellant about the truck, about being at the scene of the location where the truck was stolen, and this is 4 days prior to the underlying charge, but he was at Love's convenience store about an hour or 45 minutes or so before a truck was reported stolen.
It looks like, though, that the appellant is drawing a distinction between objecting to cross-examination, which he did not do, and objecting to the actual introduction of other witnesses' testimony and other evidence.
Yes, Your Honor. During this cross-examination, we not only did we not cross-examine appellant, but we also introduced evidence that appellant was at the scene of the location, photos on a surveillance video being at the scene of the location. We cross-examined or asked him about switching the license plates. So essentially, we went into the entire transaction of him stealing the truck, and there was no objection. The policy behind the proper objection is to prevent that evidence from going before the jury and to preserve that error when it comes up to a reviewing court. That evidence was already before the jury by the time appellant lodged his formal objection when he objected to the extraneous offense, when it was not only after the state cross-examined appellant, it was after the defense rested and the state called Detective Turnbow as its rebuttal witness. That's when the appellant first formally objected. At that time, the state argues that appellant had waived any error in this case. All the evidence was before the jury. We also contend that appellant opened the door. On the stand, as Mr. Richards noted, appellant stated that when the trial counsel brought up the truck, the truck that he used as the getaway truck, appellant stated that he believed it was Zach's truck. Later on, he found out it wasn't Zach's truck.
Okay, can you explain what that has to do with the jewelry store robbery? How is it contextual of the offense for which he's being tried?
Yes, Your Honor. It's contextual in the sense that the courts have held that same transaction evidence is generally defined as that evidence which is necessary to the understanding of the underlying offense. And I know at first blush it doesn't seem like this is contextual, but when you put this in the light of appellant's testimony, and Mr. Richards tapped on this, appellant painted this picture all throughout his testimony that he just succumbed to temptation at this robbery, that he went in there to buy a gift for his father, and just looking at these three watches, he couldn't help but resist the temptation of stealing those watches. He didn't go in there planning to rob it. He only had a soft air pistol or a BB gun, essentially. What this evidence did, and that clouded the jury's understanding of the charged offense, what this evidence did was showed appellant going to a convenience store, stealing a truck, switching the license plates to that truck, driving that truck to that jewelry store, then going into the jewelry store, robbing it, then leaving in that same truck and dumping that truck. What it did is it showed the jury the entire context of this offense. So we submit to the court that this is same transaction contextual evidence.
But the distinction is that he admitted basically to all the elements of the offense except for whether or not he used a real gun, correct?
Correct.
So really, that was the only disputed issue. I mean, I might could see your point if he had not admitted to all the other elements of the offense. That might show, or if there was an issue of identity. But it seems like it's kind of hard to say that the truck is not similar to the gun in Lockhart.
I'd also like to point the court's attention. In Lockhart, there were several pieces of evidence that the court found was same transaction contextual evidence. In that particular case, the defendant in that case drove a stolen car for 4 months, and the state introduced testimony of him robbing a used car salesman for this car and then switching the license plates. I looked at Lockhart. I couldn't understand why the victim in that case was Officer Holsey. For some reason, the Court of Criminal Appeals found that gun wasn't same transaction evidence, even though it was Officer Holsey's gun. I thought about it, and I wish I could offer you an explanation. I would point the court's attention to several cases where they have found a stolen vehicle used same transaction contextual evidence.
I believe those are cited in your brief, correct?
Yes, yes, mm-hmm. Your Honor. And in this particular case, the state still has to prove its case regardless of appellant's testimony. We have to prove all elements of the case, and this goes to appellant's intent. He's claiming that he went in there just to buy $15,000 worth of watches, although he couldn't offer any explanation how he's going to pay for those watches. He didn't have the money to pay for those watches. He was trying to create this impression or this jaunt or this backdrop that his conduct was completely innocent. And even though he admitted it to the robbery, he didn't admit to the aggravated robbery. And this gun and the fact that he stole a truck, drove it to the jewelry store, and then used that truck, switched the license plates, then used that truck, and then dumped that truck, all, we believe, makes it more likely that appellant intended and used a real firearm in this crime. Excuse me. And the state also submits in conclusion that any error in this case is harmless. In Motilla, the court said that substantial evidence of guilt can be used in the harm analysis. Here, there are 5 witnesses who claimed that they saw appellant. He admitted to the robbery. There were 5 witnesses called to testify about appellant's bad reputation for truthfulness. The evidence in this case, we believe, is overwhelming. We ask that this court affirm the conviction.
Thank you, Mr. Astor. Mr. Richards, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal. All right. All right. We thank you both for your arguments. They've been very helpful to us, and you will hear from us shortly. We're going to take a recess at this time. All right.